First, just a couple of quick announcements. One's a reminder that my office hours changed a little bit. Tuesdays and Fridays, 1 to 2. If you can't come in those times and still would like to see me individually, just send me an email. I have other times available that I could meet. Those are just the times that I am guaranteed to be in my office with an open door. But I'm happy to meet with anybody at any other time. Second announcement, I met with your fantastic TAs. They're all three of them are really terrific. They've taught the course before. They really had good ideas. And we decided to make a few little adjustments from what is in the syllabus. They will explain this in the sections, which begin this week. So in terms of the relative weight of the section participation and the exams, and other details of requirements that bear on the sections, the TA, you should follow what the TAs say, not what is in the syllabus that I handed out. Small differences, but the TAs are responsible for that, and they had very good ideas. And it just hadn't been possible for us to meet to get everything straightened out before the class, mostly because of my winter catastrophe, but also just because of scheduling. So follow what they have to say. A third thing, which I don't think was stated in the syllabus, I just want to reassure you, and the TAs will also talk about this. In the midterms and in the final, I organize those exams to not be timed exams, not just for those of you who have special needs, but for everybody. There's no class that meets after this class, so if you need an extra half hour, you won't. It's not, the exams are designed to be doable. But if you happen to need more time, I'll just stay in the room and you'll have as much time as you need. The exams are not timed. They're mostly short answers rather than multiple choice. I think I hate multiple choice. It forces you to squeeze complex ideas into a set of alternatives. And by design with multiple choice, you always have to have two answers that both are really credible, right? In which sometimes the difference between which is right and which is wrong turn out to be, I think, too subtle for the task at hand. That is, under the pressure of an exam, staring at the alternatives, I think multiple choice exams are really terrible. And sometimes students do absolutely fantastically well on short answers. You ask them a question, how do you define X? And they give you a perfect definition. You give them five possible definitions and they'll get it wrong, right? Now that's the way brains work, particularly brains under pressure. So they're short answer exams, which makes it tougher on the TAs. When it's multiple choice, they just feed it into a machine and they get the scores. But I think it's a better way to tap into how well you've studied the material and assimilated the ideas. Okay, enough preliminaries. A student came up to me before class with a question, an issue, that came out of his readings. And I'll comment on it in a second. I just want to encourage all of you to raise questions, to have issues you'd like me to talk about. The easiest thing is to send me an email, the evening before, even the morning of. Typically, I'll be able to look at it and then respond to it. Since it is hard for us to have a lot of discussion in class, we'll have some, but in a class of this size, one way of having discussion is for you to raise issues to me. So the issue raised had to do with the conflicts among the five values that I laid out in that first chapter. There's five values: freedom, democracy, fairness, efficiency, and prosperity. And it turns out, if you think about them, they often are in conflict. The simplest example, I think, is a conflict between freedom and fairness. Freedom would say that you should be able to do what you want with your own money. You earned it, it's yours. Fairness says all people should have, in some basic sense, as close to equal opportunity to make something of their lives as possible. It's unfair for some people, through no fault of their own, to be at great disadvantage. But it's equally unfair of people, through no fault of their own, through no virtue of their own, to have huge privileges. privileges and disadvantages just aren't fair. Okay, so we have a problem of fairness when you have children born into poverty and other people born into vast riches, and you have a problem of freedom. You should be able to do what you want with your money. Well, one principle is freedom always trumps fairness. Now, that's a very strong libertarian view. It says you should have complete control over your money. Taxation is a form of theft. If there is a problem of poverty and starvation, well, charity should deal with it. Rich people should, because of their own moral sensibilities, contribute to charity. And you can even say they should. You can say this is a moral obligation. It's just they shouldn't be forced to do it. Freedom says you should be allowed to be immoral, so to speak, with your own money, because it's yours. Well, very few people go that far. Most people feel, okay, it's true that it's an affront to freedom to tax rich people in order to help others who are disadvantaged, but it's a small sacrifice to force on them compared to the huge gains in fairness you might get. There's arguments on both sides. The point is that there's a tension between those values. And it's fundamentally not possible to max out on all of these values simultaneously. You can't max out on all of them. It's impossible to have the highest possible level of freedom, the highest possible level of fairness, the highest possible level of general prosperity, the highest possible level of efficiency. Efficiency turns out to go against freedom too. You know, that seems a little weird. Efficiency and freedom are in tension, because to have a really efficient society, you have to prevent corporations from doing things like massive air pollution and global warming. Those are inefficient. They create huge losses over time. To prevent global warming, you'd have to constrain and regulate corporations. No way around it. You got to do it. Got to change people's behavior by preventing them from doing things. In order to have efficiency at the highest level, you'll have to encroach on freedom in the sense of people just doing whatever they want without asking permission. So these values are in tension. I think it's absolutely fundamental to recognize those tensions and not to act as if there are simple solutions to these difficult trade-offs. There are trade-offs, and they need to be defended. Now, I think it's possible, as you will see when we get to that part of the course, to defend pretty substantial taxation in order to make very big gains in fairness. I think we can defend that. I think it's defendable. But there's plenty of arguments against it. It's not that that's an absolutely clear-cut, unambiguous thing, because it has to do with how you weight the trade-offs. How you weight the trade-offs. And I'm a strong advocate of freedom. I'm a hardcore classical liberal in that sense, 19th century liberal, believing in freedom. But I'm prepared to make significant trade-offs because I'm just as much committed to fairness as I am to freedom, and I'm prepared to sacrifice a modest amount of freedom for big gains in fairness. But some people aren't, and that's where we get political conflicts. It's important, I think, to see the conflicts in the trade-offs rather than in the values themselves. And that's a huge gain in your ability to talk to people. You know, if you think that the conflicts are always that my values are different from your values, well, then you get really hard debate. If you say we both share the same values, but we weight them differently, and we have a different sense of trade-offs, and maybe we can then convince each other about why one way of thinking about trade-offs is actually better than others. But that's hard. That's a harder set of ideas. Okay. Now we're getting down to real hardcore business of the course. American society, how it really works. Our first block is how does this complicated thing we call the economy in American society, how does it really work? And the way we're going to approach this in this block of the course is the following. Today, I'm going to give you an account of how the market is supposed to work. How in the kind of idealized picture of markets, how they are supposed to work, and by virtue of working in the way they're supposed to work, they meet some of the values we talked about, particularly the value of freedom, the value of prosperity, and the value of efficiency. So I'm going to give you a short course in kind of basic market economics about the logic of markets and what they are, how they're supposed to operate. This will be followed by an account of how markets actually work. And how they actually work shows the ways in which they not just don't live up to this idealized promise, why they can't live up to that idealized promise. That is, there's no way of perfecting markets so that they work in the idealized way. It's impossible. It's not just difficult, it's impossible. And because it's impossible, other solutions to its failures, rather than perfecting markets, are needed. That's going to be the central argument of the next lecture. The next two lectures, that's spread out over two lectures. Those two lectures are going to introduce a lot of concepts, a lot of abstract ideas, because those are ideas that turn out to apply to all sorts of things we'll be talking about. After we get the next three lectures, today and the following two, these are among the most abstract discussions we'll have, because I'm setting up frameworks of analysis for you. We're then going to discuss a series of very specific empirical problems. The environment will be the first. That'll be next Thursday, a week from Thursday. And I don't remember exactly the order, but we'll talk about healthcare, we'll talk about transportation, we'll talk about the kind of problem of training and the sort of industrial economy and how that works, jobs and the like. Okay, that's the rest of this block of the course, and that'll take you up to the first midterm. Okay. Here's the overall argument about markets and in capitalism. Markets are a desirable feature of complex economies for two basic reasons. Here's two core reasons why markets are a good thing. Markets can contribute in significant ways to efficiency and prosperity, two of our values. And market exchanges can contribute to individual freedom. So markets are a good thing because they directly impact these three values that we cared about. However, the unregulated free market with minimal government interventions ends up deeply limiting individual freedom, restricting prosperity, and undermining efficiency. And the conclusion is we need democratically accountable markets rather than unfettered, weakly regulated, in quotes, free markets. That's the overarching argument of this part of the course. Markets are a good thing. They do, in fact, enhance prosperity, efficiency, and freedom, but only if they're properly regulated, not if they're let to their own devices. And proper regulation requires that it be democratically accountable rather than done by behind closed doors by secretive elites. Okay, now let's build the concepts that we need to understand how markets are supposed to work, and that as the first step towards this broader analysis. So let's begin with the question, what in fact are we talking about? What is capitalism and what is a capitalist market? Capitalism is only one of many ways of organizing an economy. Some of this repeats things I said a little bit in the previous lecture, but I'll be doing so more systematically. Here's a definition. Capitalism is not just a free market economy. It's a market economy with two other crucial elements. First, economic enterprises are owned privately, not by the state or by communities, or by the workers in the firm. In a capitalist economy, enterprises are privately owned. They're not owned by the state, they're not owned by communities or other collective entities, and they're not owned by their employees. Second, the labor used to produce goods and services in those enterprises is obtained through voluntary market exchange in the labor market. The U.S. economy is not a pure capitalist economy. It contains many, many non-capitalist economic activities and organizations. The United States is dominated by capitalism. It's at the core of the American economy. But even in the United States, capitalist market relations are not the only way that we produce goods and services. You can think of lots of alternative ways. Let me just give you some simple examples. I mean, perhaps the simplest example is the difference between making dinner for yourself at home and going out to a restaurant and buying dinner. When you're producing a meal at home, what are you doing? You're taking raw materials, you're using means of production in your kitchen, and you're setting those means in production in motion with your labor, your activity, to transform nature, the raw materials, into a good to satisfy needs. That's the production process. That can be called part of the domestic economy. And every capitalist economy has a vibrant domestic economy. Now, there's been an important shift. I mean, this is an interesting feature of the last 50 years. A much smaller proportion of meals are now produced by the people who consume them than was true 50 years ago. People eat out at restaurants, particularly fast food restaurants, but not just fast food restaurants, vastly more than they do, than they used to do. What does that mean? It means that an arena of economic activity, the production of goods and services to satisfy human needs, that used to be self-organized by people to satisfy their own needs, is now provided by corporations, provided by a capitalist market. But still, a lot of food is produced. Food consumption is generated through a production process in the home. Now, let me give you another example that I really like. The difference between a bookstore and we're doing a video recording of the lectures too, so if you can see me talk, not just listen to me if you happen to want to. But I have to stay within a certain, let's see if I go, yeah, okay, that's about as far away as I can hobble without getting out of the camera's view. Consider the difference between a bookstore and a library. Okay, as these are two different ways that people get access to books. You go into a bookstore, go to the shelf to see if the book is there, you pull it off the shelf, you open it up and you look at the price, you ask yourself, is it worth it? Do I want to spend that amount of money to get the book? And if it's too expensive, you put it back. That's one way in which people get access to books. Libraries are another way. You go into a library, it used to be you'd go to the shelf to see if it's the book is available. Now you would check online to see if it's available. If it's available, you take it, check it out, and you have it for a period of time. If it's not available, you get on a waiting list. A good library system, a well-resourced library system that's seen as a valuable collective resource in a community, will be one in which the librarians will check the length of the waiting list, and when the waiting list gets too long, they'll order additional copies of the book. So what they use as the signal that more books need to be produced is the amount of time it takes for a person to get access to it. It's rationed by time, not by your ability to pay. So in a bookstore, books are rationed by your ability to pay. Price and your income determines your access to the books. In a library, books are rationed by your ability to wait. That's a pretty interesting idea, ability to wait. What it says is a day in the life of each person is of equal value. You know, it's a kind of deeply egalitarian, maybe too egalitarian, because some people's day waiting a day may matter more than other people's. So there may be problems in a simple waiting list where no priorities are given. But it still has this appealing feature. It really does treat all people equally. It gives everybody the same standing with respect to their access to the book. Libraries distribute books according to need, not according to ability to pay. It's a radically different kind of system for access to books, and it's fundamentally a non-market mechanism. There's a great, one of the great and beautiful ironies of American history is this. The United States has among the best public libraries in the world. If you travel around the world, as I do, and you periodically visit public libraries, you know, a public library like the Madison Public Library is orders of magnitude more comfortable, more accessible, more congenial, better resourced than libraries in most countries that have a much more active state with respect to all sorts of other things. The American library system was largely founded by charitable contributions from Andrew Carnegie at the beginning of the 20th century. He set up public libraries all across the United States in small towns. The town that I grew up, Lawrence, Kansas, has a Andrew Carnegie Library. He set up libraries all over the country because he thought it was an important failure of a market economy, the way it blocked access to information for some people, made it harder for some people than others to get access to information. Libraries then be a solution to it. All right, so the key point here is that we are a capitalist economy, but we have lots of non-capitalist forms of economic activity. You are all in a non-capitalist form of economic activity at this moment. We're producing at the University of Wisconsin a particular service, education, hopefully of a highly sophisticated and rigorous character, to both help you prepare for your own employment opportunities later, but also, equally importantly, to develop your critical capacities and your general cognitive ability to engage the world. So we're producing a service, but we produce it as a public service, funded substantially through taxation rather than by a for-profit market-oriented business. In the United States for higher education, we have lots of different ways of doing it. We have public universities. We have private nonprofit universities, the classic, you know, private liberal arts colleges and endowed universities. We also have for-profit universities. That's a new phenomenon. And in this particular domain, by every standard, the for-profit universities are worse than the public universities. For-profit universities are basically devices by which corporations soak up resources from vulnerable students and produce degrees of, even when successful, of less value than the comparable degrees produced in public institutions. But we produce education in these variety of ways. That's the first big point to make. Whoops. Funny. Oh, here. Yeah, that's what I wanted. So here's a question. Are there goods and services which you think should not be produced and distributed by a market? So the market's very good for all sorts of things. But are there some things which people consume and need that you think just shouldn't, in principle, be produced for the market? Let's take a really short 2 minutes. I'll time it for 2 minutes. So turn to somebody right next to you and just go for it. Just start talking. Turn to somebody in your immediate vicinity and think about things you think should not be produced for a market, exchanged on a market. Okay, so what do you think? Yeah. So, well, that's a strong statement, that guns shouldn't be bought and sold on the market. That one could hardly find a more controversial in American society. So one would certainly perhaps say that bazookas, or how about, missiles. So on the general idea of weapons, most people don't think that we should have a free market in nuclear weapons. I mean, even the most hardcore gun advocates think that nuclear-tipped, rifles, if such things exist, shouldn't be allowed. clearly there's some limit that we think on the exchange of weapons of violence. The broadest category, guns, of course, would be extremely controversial in American society. Other ideas? Yeah?
Healthcare,
okay, so it's interesting. We're both, the first two examples are both examples of things which are currently sold on the market and which there are arguments, perhaps this is not a good thing to sell on the market. There might be other things. There are things we don't sell on the market, and some people think we should, and other people think we don't. We'll have a big discussion about the pros and cons of markets with healthcare in a couple of weeks. Yeah?
I think illegal drugs, just so hard for
illegal. Illegal drugs.
Yeah.
So drugs which are currently illegal include some kinds of substances which many people think ought to be sold on a market, like marijuana. So marijuana is legal in Colorado now, it's not legal in Wisconsin. That's clearly a case where there's some ambiguity as to whether or not it should be sold on a market. There are arguments that even drugs like heroin, if sold on a market but regulated, you actually generate less heroin use. That regulating a dangerous substance and allowing it to be sold is a better way to deal with the problem. So it recognizes that there is a problem, but it's possible that you actually create less social problem by allowing it but regulating it rather than by criminalizing it. Other thoughts? Yeah?
Pornography.
Okay, so that's a tricky one because of the way, of course, that directly bounces up against freedom, and particularly, you know, free speech issues. And then there's, of course, the very difficult question of where you draw the line around the forms of media expression of sexuality that are to be banned because of some criterion and the forms that are to be accepted. Yeah?
Prisons.
Okay, so that's, it's not exactly a market in prisons, but we do have private prisons so that the government will subcontract. It's not that just anybody can go out and buy a prison. So that's a special kind of problem. What sorts of things should be provided by and paid for by the government? Those prisons are still paid for by the government. Although there are prisons now which charge inmates room and board, so that inmates leave prison in debt. I mean, it's, you know, it creates a monstrous cycle of desperation. Other things. Yeah. Oh, you and then you. Yeah.
College,
universities. Should we have a market in universities, or should it be publicly provided? Now, that's different from whether it should be free or paid for. You can have a publicly provided university where you still charge fees. So the national parks, for example, are something you have to pay a fee to enter. So part of the costs, because after all, public provision still requires resources, part of the costs of going to the national parks are paid for by the people who go there, and part of it is paid by taxes. That's true at universities. Part of your education is being paid for by taxes, and part of it is being paid for by tuition. If you're an in-state Wisconsin student, about a third of the cost of your education is paid for by your own tuition. It's a little hard to calculate exactly because you have to separate out the costs of a university that are directly connected to the educational function as opposed to the other things that universities do. But it's the order of magnitude is a third. Yeah, you had.
I said
payday loans. So that's a case. So loans, most people think loans in general, we do need a credit market. We would be a much more rigid and dysfunctioning economy if it was not possible for people to get loans. The question is, should we have a free market in loans? Should we have a way of organizing the access to credit in which anything goes? Anybody can set up shop and make loans under any contractual conditions they wish. Well, the argument against payday loans is that they're predatory, that they take advantage of the vulnerability of people and create a form of loan that's extortionist and therefore is at least regulated and in many places in the world simply disallowed. Let me give you a couple of other examples that are sort of different from the things we've been talking about. Babies. You know, we have a process by which people can adopt children. There are children in the world without parents, and there are parents in the world without children. And we have an adoption process through which people get access to babies. Should we have a market in babies? Should we have an auction, you know, where people who have babies that they don't want go to this, you know, auction market, and people come and inspect the babies and they put in bids? Well, most people find that just horrifying as an idea. There are libertarians who say that would be great. That would be great. You'd have mutual improvement. The people who don't want their babies would make more money, and the people who want babies would have an easier time getting babies. And indeed, in such a world, you'd start having people producing babies in order to sell them on the market. It would certainly be the case that there would be fewer grief-stricken families without babies who find it very difficult to adopt. There would be fewer such families in a world where we had a production process of babies for adoption sold on a market. So people who are strong defenders of the market say, why not? Let's go for it. People who feel that there's something about that which is a violation of human dignity and an affront to other values we care about, and that it would have all sorts of pernicious second-order effects that makes them very hesitant to have a free market in babies. But what about a free market in body parts? Now, some body parts we actually do have a free market in. Hair, for example. I mean, hair is something you grow from your body. We cut it off all the time. And if you let it grow long and you've got really attractive hair and you cut it off, you can actually make quite a lot of money from the sale of your hair to wig makers. And there are places in the world where that's a real source of income for poor, especially for poor people, selling hair. And most people don't find that sordid. They don't find that, you know, kind of a disgusting practice. Blood is another body part that we have a market for. And there's a really interesting social scientific literature which actually shows that you get more blood donations if you can't sell it than if you have a market. Because there's two reasons why you would want to give your blood to a blood bank. One is a sense of moral obligation that people need it. I have it. I'm healthy. It's not that big a deal to donate blood. And you're contributing to the common good and helping your fellow persons. That's called altruism. That's a kind of moral motivation to do things, to give unto others. It turns out that if you start paying people for blood donations, you undercut the moral obligation. Fewer people will see that it's their moral duty to do so if they see that there's a market in blood. And the research is quite unequivocal that monetized markets in blood reduce the supply and reduce the quality, because you'll get more sick people, more people with hepatitis or with other illnesses wanting to donate blood because they're desperate for money. So that's a body part where there's, you know, a clear problem in deciding whether or not you want to make it available. And then there's a big debate these days about whether there should be a free market in kidneys. Many people die each year because of a lack of cadaver kidneys. So the main way that kidney transplants occur is when there's a death and a kidney donor has indicated that they want their body parts made available for life-saving purposes. And the fact of the matter is that the waiting list for kidneys is greater than the supply of kidneys. Once again, I have, there, now we're on airplane mode. And I want to just check to see that that didn't kill off. No, the recording is still going. So there are people who say what we need is a free market in kidneys. And there are places in the world where you can buy a kidney. I don't believe in any rich country is it allowed to simply go out and buy a kidney. We have strict rules about the nature of the waiting list, about the priority, and you can't buy your way to the top of the list. There are examples where people do so through various backdoor ways, but it's frowned upon. And the medical community is dead set against the idea of people being able to pay to get themselves higher on the list of availability for heart donations or kidney donations. Now, the thing about kidney donations are that since our design as an animal is that we only need one kidney, you can have live donors. Most people who have really thought about this think that actually more harm than good would be done by having an open free market. Again, it would mean that desperate and poor people for whom selling a kidney would solve some financial problems would be made vulnerable to the market in body parts. All right, so all of this is just to kind of, yeah. It would. You certainly wouldn't have a black market in kidneys if you had an open market in kidneys. And it's conceivable if the black market was so big and filled with so many other problems of coercion and the like, there could be circumstances in which you would say, perhaps reluctantly, on balance, a regulated free market would be better than a black market. But that's the same point could be made about babies. There is a black market where you can buy babies. Now, there are places you can go in the world, and if you have enough cash, you can get a baby. Still, most people would be reluctant to say, well, that means we should shift all the way and have a regulated but open market in babies. Now, my point here is not to come down one way or another on any particular example, but just to show that even if you think that markets are a really good thing because they promote efficiency, prosperity, and freedom, there are areas of our lives where people are hesitant to say an open free market is the best way to provide these services. And there are many other things you could put on the list. Okay. So now let's go to the arguments in defense of capitalist markets. Why are these a good thing? First argument is a moral argument. Capitalist markets promote freedom. And the second argument is what's called a pragmatic argument. Capitalist markets promote efficiency and prosperity. These are quite independent of each other. They're really quite distinct arguments. You could believe that capitalist markets promote freedom and therefore are desirable, even if you acknowledge that in many respects they also generate inefficiencies and reduce prosperity. You could say, well, that's just the price we pay for freedom. Most people who defend capitalist markets on the grounds of freedom also insist it's the optimal way of promoting efficiency and prosperity. It delivers the goods. It doesn't just make you free. It delivers the goods. But these are two really quite distinct arguments. Let's look at the structure of these arguments, how they work as defenses. First, the moral argument. Pretty straightforward. Markets promote individual freedom since in a free market, all transactions are the result of voluntary agreements. No one is forced to do anything. You're not forced to buy any particular product when you go into a store. If you are hired in a job and you dislike it, you are free to quit. Capitalism promotes freedom, and capitalist markets promote freedom in this very deep and real way that transactions are the result of voluntary agreements. The kind of freedom here is what is called negative freedom. It's freedom from coercion. Negative freedom. Nobody tells you you have to buy something. That's why there was so much objection to the mandate in the Obama healthcare policy, because it said you are required to buy health insurance, and that violates the freedom of the market. We have other cases where we force people to buy things. So for example, if you own a car, you're forced to have insurance. You know, it's a law. You have to have insurance if you have a car. But of course, you're not forced to buy a car. Now, that's a little bit of a thin argument, and given the nature of public transportation and the lives most people live, in most parts of the country, it's a pretty big disadvantage in life to not have a car. For many people, especially once you have children and a family to deal with. So it really is the case that forcing people to buy insurance for a car isn't all that different from forcing them to buy insurance from the healthcare market, but there is a difference. And that was the heart of that big objection to the what's called the individual mandate, that you had to buy health insurance once that program was in place. The kind of freedom here is called negative freedom. We will contrast that later with positive freedom. That is the freedom to actually do things, to have the capacity to put your life plans into effect. That's positive freedom, the freedom to, whereas negative freedom is the freedom from. That is, you're free from coercion. And that, I think, is a serious and important argument. It's probably the most compelling moral basis upon an achievement of a market economy, in that it expands the range of interactions that people have in which they are free to choose, to use an expression that Milton Friedman, the economist, introduced. Okay, the pragmatic argument. A pragmatic argument, the word pragmatic means an argument that solves some kind of practical problem. The pragmatic argument for capitalist markets is the following. There is a big problem that has to be solved in any complex economic system. How to organize cooperation and coordination in a complex world. There are two basic solutions to this. The first is planning and command, and the second is markets and voluntary exchange. I mean, just think of the difficulty of solving these problems. You want to build a house in Madison. In order to build a house, you need a vast array of inputs. You need lumber, nails, electrical wiring, ceramic tiles, carpets. You need all this stuff. And each of these inputs into your own house building project themselves required a vast array of inputs in order to be manufactured. How in the world are you going to get people to collaborate and cooperate with you to provide all of these inputs and the inputs to the inputs that you need in order to build a house? That's a problem of cooperation and coordination. How in the world can you do it? One way to do it would be to have a central authority which would say we need so many nails and we need so much lumber and we need so much carpets of particular varieties, and they need these inputs, and you have a big spreadsheet, an input-output matrix, and big computers to calculate how much of each thing you need, and then you command that they be produced by the facilities that produce those inputs. Well, you can see that's a hugely complicated process, and where it's been tried, it's proved to be extremely inefficient and difficult to execute in a reasonable way. So that's a tremendous problem, coordinating complex cooperation. Markets and voluntary exchange are one way of doing this. Transactions are bilaterally voluntary. And in the idealized market, everyone has full information in whenever they make an exchange. Well, how do markets solve the problem? How do markets actually get this coordination going? How does it happen? Adam Smith's Invisible Hand is the kind of classic story. It's a nice classic quote. You probably have encountered this, or perhaps in some other context. I don't read many quotes during the semester, but here's one. An individual who intends only his own gain is led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Nor is it always worse for society that it was no part of it. By pursuing his own interests, he frequently promotes that of the society more effectively than when he really intends to promote it. How does it work? The key mechanism for solving this problem of coordinating vast numbers of people in a complex system in which everyone is simply motivated by their own interest, the key mechanism that accomplishes this is supply and demand plus prices, which leads to coordination through information and incentives generated by prices. So here's the conventional story. I mean, when you think about it, prices are kind of weird. I mean, you have a certain number of apples and a certain number of hammers, and we say 10 apples are the same as one hammer. They're worth the same because the price of 10 apples turns out to be the same as one hammer. I mean, apples and hammers have nothing to do with each other. They're completely different kinds of things. You eat one, you hammer with another. These are completely different sorts of things, and yet there's something which says they're of equal value that's represented by their price. Well, here's the conventional story about how this works. If not enough of something is produced, then the people who want it bid up the price. The price will go up if there's insufficient supply. When the price rises, this is a signal to the producers of that thing, the producers of apples or hammers. The price rises, it's a signal to them, aha, if I produce more, I'll be able to make greater profit because they have certain costs of producing something, and the price rises, the difference between what it costs to produce and the price, that difference gets bigger. So there's an incentive created to the producers of things to produce more when it is in short supply. There's an incentive to produce more when it's in short supply because the price rises, and the increase in price means you can make greater profits in the production. This leads to greater production. So the supply rises to meet the demand, and so the prices fall back to their equilibrium level, where prices roughly track what it costs to produce something. Eventually, no one is willing to produce more of the thing in question at that price, which means that the price must be pretty close to the cost of producing the things in question. You know, if the price is way above the cost of producing, then you have a big incentive to produce more. Of course, if the price is below the cost of producing, you have no incentive to produce more because you're losing money every time you produce something. This is a chronic problem in agriculture. You know, any of you, I'm sure some of you come from farms, maybe dairy farms. It's a chronic problem in Wisconsin, what the price of milk is, because farmers have huge fixed costs, and some years the price of milk is less than the cost of producing milk. And what we have in the United States, as in every other economically developed country, we have a system of price subsidies to farmers so that they can smooth out their income across years in which the price of milk falls below the cost of producing, rather than facing a crisis every 3 or 4 years, which would make it impossible to have stable agriculture. The purpose of price subsidies in agriculture is not to violate the market, but to enable people to have a stable relationship to the market. Well, that's a side point. The key issue here is that the movement of prices above and near the cost of producing are what tell producers to produce more or less of things. It provides information. It's a signal. And that constant adjustment process over time leads to an equilibrium of supply and demand and the corresponding prices. The key idea that underlies this is the idea that incentives are generated, incentives and information are generated by prices. Coordination through information and incentive generated by prices. When you go to a store and buy a chocolate bar, what you think you're doing is simply purchasing an item from the shelf of the store. You're actually doing something way more complicated. You are directly, or I guess indirectly through a series of steps, you're communicating with cocoa growers in Nigeria. There are cocoa farmers in Nigeria who produce the cocoa beans that end up in your chocolate bar. When you purchase chocolate bars, what you're doing is sending information through this complex web and network of exchanges to all the producers of the inputs into chocolate bars as to whether they're producing the right amount or more needs or less needs to be produced. The implication of this is what's called consumer sovereignty and allocative efficiency. Consumer sovereignty means that ultimately it's the consumer that decides what gets produced in a market. The consumer decides. Consumer sovereignty. It's your decision to purchase a chocolate bar rather than an apple, which communicates to chocolate growers rather than apple growers in this chain of communication that there's a demand for what they're producing. Yeah. The question is whether this all rests on the extortion of labor. We will get to the implications for inequalities and vulnerability later. At this point, I'm just trying to lay out the logic by which markets are supposed to generate efficiency and coordination. Coordination is a difficult problem. You have to do it somehow or other. I, in fact, think markets are a crucial part of coordination. We do need markets. At this point, I'm just laying out the defense in terms of how they're supposed to work. We'll get to problems of inequality that get generated as a side effect of this in due course. So consumer sovereignty is simple. It just means that ultimately it's the people who buy stuff that determine what gets produced. So it's not the automobile manufacturers who determine what gets produced, it's the purchasers of cars, because you have choice. You can punish those manufacturers who produce the wrong kind of car and reward those manufacturers who produce the cars you want. And because you have the power to punish and reward, it's you who decide what gets produced. That's consumer sovereignty. But it also, this price supply and demand mechanism, it also generates what's called allocative efficiency. Now that's a harder concept, and to explain it, I have to introduce a technical term. So here's one of the places where we're hitting some real thick weeds. This is a technical idea, Pareto optimality. This is what is meant by allocative efficiency. Allocative means how you allocate things. Allocative efficiency means you're allocating things in an efficient way. We're producing more chocolate bars and fewer apples because people are preferring chocolate bars to apples. That's an efficient allocation of agricultural resources across those two products. Okay, let me explain what this idea means. First, the term optimality. Optimality simply means a situation which is as good as possible. An optimal solution, then, is a solution to a problem that is as close to perfect as possible. Optimal doesn't mean perfect. It just means as good as possible. You can't do better. Pareto optimality is a kind of optimality. So here's the technical definition of Pareto optimality. It's named after an Italian economist in the 19th century, Wilfredo Pareto, who introduced this idea. A distribution satisfies Pareto optimality when it is the case that no one can be made better off without someone being made worse off. If we distribute things to a group of people, and there's no alternative distribution which would make somebody better off without making anybody worse off, then you have the Pareto optimal distribution. Let me just give you a simple example. Let us suppose there's 150 people in this class, roughly. Let's suppose that I come to class with 75 oranges and 75 apples, and I randomly distribute them to you. So some of you get apples and some of you get oranges. Now, some people who prefer oranges got apples, and some people who prefer apples got oranges. If I say nobody is allowed to exchange their fruit, then clearly we are at a suboptimal distribution. Because some people could be made better off without anybody being made worse off. I then say, okay, you can trade. And people with apples that they want to get rid of raise their hand, and they swap back and forth. And eventually there's nobody with an apple who actually wants an orange that can find a person with an orange that wants an apple. Now at that point, the only way to make this unhappy apple owner happy, better off, would be to take an orange away from somebody who would prefer an orange. So at that point, nobody can be made better off without somebody being made worse off. That's the kind of efficiency that markets are supposed to give us. Since everybody is free to trade whatever they want, everybody's free to engage in voluntary exchange. Once everybody has done all the exchanging they want to do, everybody has bought and sold what they want to sell, any redistribution of products or income would make somebody worse off in order to make somebody else better off. You can't get an orange to an apple, an orange preferer, without taking it away from somebody who prefers an orange. That's Pareto optimality. And the basic claim about markets is that markets generate Pareto optimality of the distribution of things exchanged on the market. That's the kind of efficiency which markets generate. Now, as we'll see when we talk about some of the problems with markets, one of the premises of this, of course, is that everybody has perfect information. Let us suppose that because you've held this orange, you realize that it's actually rotten inside. But you don't share that information with the person who wants to trade the apple with you. That's called asymmetric information. The seller has more information about the product than the buyer. It's a chronic problem in markets that sellers know more about what they're selling than buyers know about what they're buying. And it often takes too much research and too much time and effort for the buyer to get adequate information. That's why we have, rules about product, about advertising. You can't make false claims. You can't, in terms of selling products. Well, if you don't have perfect information, you can then see how you have free exchange, and then somebody is made worse off by virtue of voluntary exchange, because they've done so under faulty information. They end up with a rotten orange, whereas even though they preferred oranges to apples, they preferred good apples to rotten oranges. We'll come back to this problem of information, which is a major issue, not a small wrinkle, in understanding how markets work. So there are, just to finish up this part of the discussion about the nature of efficiency and the ways in which markets promote efficiency, we've talked about allocative efficiency. The distribution of things is Pareto optimal. That's the most efficient distribution. But there's another kind of efficiency that is associated with markets, which is called dynamic efficiency. Dynamic efficiency refers to the optimal innovation and growth through the incentives for risk-taking. The dynamic efficiency is very different from Pareto optimality. It's not just about the distribution of final products. It's about change over time. Markets create incentives for people to take risk. The iconic story is that innovators take risks with unproven inventions. Right? That's what... This says there's no audio. No, there's audio. I guess this fell. Innovators take risks when they try to invent things. Most innovations fall flat. Most people fail in their efforts to create innovation. But if you succeed, there's a big payoff. And it's the potential for that big payoff which is the incentive to take risks. The idea here is basically like a casino or lottery. You take a gamble and you get the payoff if you win. This seems okay to most people. You know, as long as you enter the lottery with full knowledge, as long as you don't hurt anyone else in the process, as long as you bear the costs of your own risks when you take them, then you deserve the payoff if you get it. That's dynamic efficiency. And it's one of the great virtues of capitalism historically. Capitalism created a process through competition in which there was much greater incentive and pressure, not just incentive, but pressure on people to take risks and innovate. And that's what generated the rapid process of technological change that's occurred over the last 150 or 200 years compared to the pace of technological change in earlier societies. It's not that in earlier societies people were less intelligent. It's not that our IQ suddenly went up. It's that the social organization of risk-taking and innovation changed. And it was a combination of the way markets worked and the way private incentives work, particularly around this issue of taking risks, that generated this innovation dynamic of capitalism. And that's called dynamic efficiency. So all of these are very good arguments for why we should be in favor of markets. We'll see in the next lecture that it's not the whole story and why there are problems, which mean that free markets aren't the best way to utilize markets. But these are serious and important parts of the defense of markets. Well, there's one final topic that we need to discuss. And that's the relationship of markets to government. Because even if you come to recognize that there are problems with markets, you might still argue that free markets are better than regulated markets because any efforts at regulation are just going to make things worse. You know, you can have a disease and the cure can be worse than the disease, and so you decide not to have treatment. That doesn't mean you don't recognize that there's a problem, it's just that it's a problem without a solution. And this has to do with the relationship of markets to limited government. There are two core arguments against state interference with the market. I will be, in subsequent lectures, talking a lot about why we need state interference with the market. Here I'm saying the arguments against state interference with the market. First, there is a moral argument. State coercion inherently reduces freedom. Therefore, limited government rather than an affirmative state is better. That's an intrinsic feature of state intervention, is that it does directly constrain people's individual autonomy. That's what it does. That's what taxation is. All taxation coercively takes resources from people and allocates it to some public purpose. And that's an argument against government. It's an argument against government if particularly you believe that freedom is an absolute value and trumps all other considerations. If you care more about you care so much about freedom that you're prepared to sacrifice efficiency, prosperity, fairness, and even democracy. But there's also a pragmatic argument against state interference, against state regulation of markets, state interventions to correct the problems which we will be discussing in the way markets function. And this is an argument about state incompetence and state malevolence. And I think this is the argument that actually has more bite. In the current political scene, it's really state incompetence and state malevolence that's the main argument that is being raised against state regulation, rather than simply the sheer fact that state regulations represent an interference with freedom. It's more that incompetence and malevolence. Incompetence says that the unintended negative effects of government intervention are pervasive, and they always do more harm than good. This was an argument that Milton Friedman made. He argued that, yes, competitive markets tend to produce very powerful corporations which have tendencies to monopoly. And they like to control the market rather than simply respond to it. But he said government efforts to break up monopolies always create more problems than they solve. So it's not that he said monopolies were a good thing. And he even admitted that monopolies violate the principles of the market, that they make markets work less efficiently. But he said governments simply don't have the competence to solve this problem effectively. If that's true, of course, it's a very good argument. You know, it's all well and good to complain about market imperfections, about market failures, about all sorts of problems generated by markets. But if indeed any effort to improve things makes things worse, that's a good argument against trying to improve things. I don't think, in fact, that argument is correct, but it's a credible argument that has to be contended with. Secondly, there's an argument of state malevolence. I call this the Frankenstein problem. Building up the state to do good things creates a machinery, creates a state apparatus, it creates an establishment, to use the current fashionable term for these issues. It creates an establishment in which bureaucrats pursue their own interests and enrich themselves at the expense of the people, and in which private, powerful actors can capture pieces of the state for their own special interests. So this means not simply that the state is incompetent, but that the state is a bad actor, that it's not even attempting really to serve the interests of people, because when you create an apparatus that has that amount of power, then the people who sit in those positions of power will use the state for their own enrichment and their own interests. And powerful external actors will manipulate them for their special interests. Well, if you believe both of these claims, that the state is intrinsically incompetent, it simply can't solve these problems. And furthermore, that when you make a state powerful enough to attempt to solve these problems, it will not even try to really solve the problems because the interests of the actors in the state will be directed towards their own enrichment. If you believe the incompetence and malevolence thesis, then, of course, limited government is the necessary, desirable response, even though it means that there will be failures in the way markets perform. Well, those are the basic arguments in favor of a free market. Just to sum it up in 1 minute, there's the positive arguments for the free market because it enhances freedom, prosperity, and efficiency. It does so through allocative efficiency, this Pareto optimality, and dynamic efficiency. And it does so intrinsically because it allows voluntary contracts. And free markets need to remain free, not regulated, because states are incompetent and malevolent. And that's a sad state of the world, but it's the best we can do. Or so some people claim. We will turn to the counter arguments in the next couple of lectures. Thank you.